interloper, always out to ingratiate himself with both sides, always presenting himself as the splendid chap who wants to help everybody. Perhaps Kojiro had thought that if he told Musashi how strong the enemy was, Musashi would get down on his hands and knees and ask him to serve as his second. And, conceivably, if Musashi's first objective had been to preserve his own life, he would have welcomed assistance. But even before meeting Kojiro, he had picked up enough information to know he might have to face 100 men. It wasn't that he had forgotten the lesson Takuan had taught him. The truly brave man is one who loves life, cherishing it as a treasure that once fortified can never be recovered. He well knew that to live was more than merely to survive. The problem was how to imbue his life with meaning, how to ensure that his life would cast a bright ray of light into the future, even if it became necessary to give up that life for a cause. If he succeeded in doing this, the length of his life, 20 years or 70, made little difference. A lifetime was only an insignificant interval in the endless flow of time. To Musashi's way of thinking, there was one way of life for ordinary people, another for the warrior. It was vitally important for him to live like a samurai and to die like one. There was no turning back from the path he had chosen. Even if he was hacked to pieces, the enemy could not obliterate the fact of his having responded fearlessly and honestly to the challenge. He gave his attention to the routes available. The shortest, as well as the widest and easiest to travel, was the road Kojiro had taken. Another, not quite so direct, was a path leading along the Takano River, a tributary of the Kamo, to the Ohara High Road and then by way of the Shugakuin Imperial Villa to Ichijoji. The third route went east for a short distance, then north as far as the foothills of Uryu, and finally across a path into the village. The three roads met at the spreading pine. The difference in distance was insignificant. Yet from the viewpoint of a small force attacking a much larger one, the approach was all important. The choice itself could decide victory or defeat. Instead of weighing the problem at some length, after only a momentary pause, he started running in a direction almost opposite from that of Ichijoji. First, he crossed over the foot of Kagura Hill to a point behind the tomb of the Emperor Go Ichijo. Then, passing through a thick bamboo grove, he came to a mountain stream flowing through a village in the northwest. Looming above him was the north shoulder of Mount Daimonji. Silently, he began climbing. Through the trees on his right, he could see a garden wall, apparently belonging to the Ginkakuji. Almost directly beneath him, the jujube-shaped pond in the garden shone like a mirror. As he went farther up, the pond was lost in the trees, and the rippling Kamo River came into view. He felt as though he held the whole city in the palm of his hand. He stopped for a moment to check his position. By proceeding horizontally across the sides of four hills, he could reach a point above and behind the spreading pine, where he could command a bird's-eye view of the enemy's position. Like Oda Nobunaga at the Battle of Okehazama, he had spurned the usual routes in favor of a difficult detour. "Who goes there?" Musashi froze and waited. Footsteps approached cautiously. Seeing a man dressed like a samurai in the service of a court noble, Musashi decided he was not a member of the Yoshioka forces. The man's nose was smudged from the smoke of his torch. His kimono was damp and mud-spattered. He uttered a little cry of surprise. Musashi stared at him suspiciously. "Aren't you Miyamoto Musashi?" the man asked with a low bow, his eyes tinged with fright. Musashi's eyes brightened in the light of the torch. "Are you Miyamoto Musashi?" Terrified, the samurai seemed to wobble slightly on his feet. The fierceness in Musashi's eyes was something not often encountered in human beings. "Who are you?" Musashi asked crisply.
Stop stammering. Who are you?
I'm from the house of Lord Karasumaru Mitsuhiro.
I'm Miyamoto Musashi, but what's a retainer of Lord Karasumaru's doing up here in the middle of the night?
Then you are Musashi,
he sighed with relief.
The next instant, he was running at breakneck speed down the mountain, his torch trailing light behind him.
Musashi turned and continued on his way across the mountainside. When the samurai reached the vicinity of the Ginkakuji, he shouted,
Kura! Where are you?
We're here! Where are you?
It wasn't the voice of Kura, another retainer of Karasumaru, but that of Jotaro.
Jotaro! Is that you?
Yes!
Come up here fast! I can't! Otsu can't walk any farther!
The samurai swore under his breath, raised his voice even higher and shouted,
Come quick! I found Musashi! Musashi! If you don't hurry, we'll lose him!
Jotaro and Otsu were about 200 yards farther down the path. It took a while for their two long shadows, seemingly linked together, to hobble up to the samurai. He waved his torch to hurry them on, and in a matter of seconds could hear for himself Otsu's labored breathing. Her face looked whiter than the moon. The travel paraphernalia on her thin arms and legs seemed cruel and absurd. But when the light fell full upon her, her cheeks took on a ruddy hue.
Is it true?
She panted.
Yes, I just saw him.
Then, in a more urgent tone,
If you hurry, you should be able to catch him. But if you waste time...
Which way?
Asked Jotaro, exasperated at being caught between an agitated man and an ailing woman. Otsu's physical condition had by no means improved, but once Jotaro had divulged the news of Musashi's impending battle, there was no way of keeping her in bed, even if that might prolong her life. Disregarding all entreaties, she had tied up her hair, laced on her straw sandals, and all but staggered out of Lord Karasumaru's gate. Once the impossibility of stopping her had become apparent, Lord Karasumaru did all he could to help. He took charge of the operation himself, and while she was limping slowly toward the Ginkakuji, sent his men to scour the various approaches to Ichijoji village. The men walked until their feet ached and had been on the verge of giving up when the quarry was found. The samurai pointed, and Otsu started resolutely up the hill. Jotaro, fearing she might collapse, asked at every other step,
Are you all right? Can you make it?
She did not reply. Truth to tell, she did not even hear him. Her emaciated body was responsive only to the need to reach Musashi. Though her mouth was parched, cold sweat poured from her ashen forehead.
This must be the way, said Jotaro, hoping to encourage her. This road goes to Mount Hiei. It's all flat from now on. No more climbing. Do you want to rest for a moment?
Silently, she shook her head, clinging firmly to the stick they were carrying between them, struggling for breath, as though all life's difficulties were compressed into this one journey. When they'd managed to cover nearly a mile, Jotaro shouted,
Musashi! Sensei!
And went on shouting. His strong voice bolstered Otsu's courage, but before long her strength was gone.
Jotaro,
she whispered weakly. She let go of the stick and sank into the grass by the road. Face to the ground, she clasped her delicate fingers over her mouth. Her shoulders jerked convulsively.
Otsu! It's blood! You're spitting up blood! Oh, Otsu!
On the brink of tears, he clasped his arms around her waist and held her up. She shook her head slowly from side to side. Not knowing what else to do, Jotaro patted her gently on the back.
What do you want?
He asked. She was beyond replying.
I know. Water. Is that it?
She nodded feebly.
Wait here. I'll get some.
He stood up and looked around, listened for a moment, and went to a nearby ravine where he heard water running.
With little difficulty, he found a spring bubbling forth from the rocks. As he started to scoop up some water with his hands, he hesitated, eyes fixed on the tiny crabs at the bottom of the pristine pool. The moon wasn't shining directly on the water, but the reflection of the sky was more beautiful than the silver-white clouds themselves. Deciding to take a sip himself before carrying out his task, he moved a few feet to one side and bent down on his hands and knees, craning his neck like a duck. Then he gasped, "Apparition?" And his body bristled like a chestnut in its burr. Reflected in the small pool was a striped pattern, half a dozen trees on the other side. Right beside them was the image of Musashi. Jotaro thought his imagination was playing tricks on him, that the reflection would soon dissolve. When it failed to go away, he raised his eyes very slowly.
"You're here!" he cried. "You're really here!"
The peaceful reflection of the sky turned to mud as he splashed across to the other side, wetting his kimono to the shoulders.
"You're here!"
He threw his arms around Musashi's legs.
"Quiet," said Musashi softly. "It's dangerous here. Come back later."
"No, I found you. I'm staying with you."
"Quiet. I heard your voice. I've been waiting here. Now take Otsu some water. It's muddy now. There's another brook over there. See? Here, take this with you."
He held out a bamboo tube. Jotaro raised his face and said,
"No. You take it to her."
They stood like that for a few seconds. Then Musashi nodded and went to the other brook. Having filled the tube, he carried it to Otsu's side. He put his arm around her gently and held the tube to her mouth. Jotaro stood beside them.
"Look, Otsu! It's Musashi! Don't you understand? Musashi!"
As Otsu sipped the cool water, her breath came a little more easily, though she remained limp in Musashi's arm. Her eyes seemed to be focused on something very far away.
"Don't you see, Otsu? Not me, Musashi! It's Musashi's arm around you, not mine!"
Burning tears gathered in her vacant eyes until they looked like glass. Two streams sparkled down her cheeks. She nodded.
Jotaro was beside himself with joy.
"You're happy now, aren't you? This is what you wanted, isn't it?"
Then to Musashi,
"She's been saying over and over that whatever happened, she had to see you. She wouldn't listen to anybody. Please tell her, if she keeps on acting like this, she'll die. She won't pay any attention to me. Maybe she'll do what you tell her."
"It was all my fault," said Musashi. "I'll apologize and tell her to take better care of herself. Jotaro."
"Yes?"
"Would you leave us alone, just for a little while?"
"Why? Why can't I stay here?"
"Don't be that way, Jotaro," Otsu said pleadingly.
"Just for a few minutes, please." "Oh, all right."
He couldn't refuse Otsu, even if he didn't understand.
"I'll be up the hill. Call me when you're through."
Otsu's natural shyness was magnified by her illness, and she could not decide what to say. Musashi, embarrassed, turned his face away from her. With her back to him, she stared at the ground. He gazed up at the sky. He feared instinctively that no words existed to tell her what was in his heart. All that had happened since the night she had freed him from the cryptomeria tree passed through his mind, and he recognized the purity of the love that had kept her searching for him these 5 long years. Who was stronger? Who had suffered more? Otsu, her life difficult and complex, burning with a love she could not conceal? Or he himself, hiding his feelings behind a stony face, burying the embers of his passion under a layer of cold ashes? Musashi had thought before, and thought now, that his way was the more painful. Yet there was strength and valor in Otsu's constancy. The burden she had borne was too heavy for most men to bear alone.
Only a short time to go, thought Musashi.
The moon was low in the sky, the light whiter now. Dawn was not far away. Soon both the moon and he himself would fade behind the mountain of death. He must, in the short time remaining, tell Otsu the truth. He owed her that much, for her devotion and her faithfulness. But the words would not come. The harder he tried to speak, the more tongue-tied he became. He watched the sky helplessly, as though inspiration might descend from it. Otsu stared at the ground and wept. Within her heart was a flaming love, a love so strong that it had driven everything else out. Principles, religion, concern for her own welfare, pride, all paled beside this one consuming passion. In some way, she believed, this love simply had to overcome Musashi's resistance. Somehow, through her tears, a way must be found for them to live together, apart from the world of ordinary people. But now that she was with him, she was helpless. She could not bring herself to describe the pain of being away from him, the misery of traveling through life alone, the agony she suffered over his lack of feeling. If only she had a mother to whom she could pour out all her sorrows. The long silence was broken by the honking of a flock of geese. Attuned to the approach of dawn, they rose above the trees and flew off over the mountain tops. "The geese are flying north," said Musashi, conscious of the irrelevance.
"Musashi."
Their eyes met in a shared memory of the years in the village when the geese had passed high above each spring and fall. Everything had been so simple then. She had been friendly with Matahachi. Musashi she had disliked because of his roughness, but she had never been afraid to talk back to him when he said insulting things to her. Each now thought of the mountain where the Shippoji stood and the banks of the Yoshino River below. And both knew they were squandering precious moments, moments that would never return. "Jotaro said you were ill. Is it very bad?"
"It's nothing serious."
"Are you feeling better now?"
"Yes, but it's of no importance. Are you really expecting to be killed today?"
"I'm afraid so."
"If you die, I can't go on living. Perhaps that's why it's so easy to forget about my sickness now."
A certain light came into her eyes, and it made him feel the weakness of his own determination as compared to hers. To acquire even a degree of self-control, he had had to ponder the question of life and death for many years, discipline himself at every turn of the road, force himself to undergo the rigors of a samurai's training. With no training or conscious self-discipline, this woman was able to say without the slightest hesitation that she, too, was prepared to die if he did. Her face expressed perfect serenity, her eyes telling him she was neither lying nor speaking impulsively. She seemed almost happy over the prospect of following him in death. He wondered, with a tinge of shame, how women could be so strong.
"Don't be a fool, Otsu," he suddenly blurted. "There's no reason why you should die."
The strength of his own voice and the depth of his feelings surprised even him.
"It's one thing for me to die fighting against the Yoshiokas. Not only is it right for a man who lives by the sword to die by the sword, I have a duty to remind those cowards of the way of the samurai. Your willingness to follow me in death is deeply touching, but what good would it do? No more than the pitiful death of an insect."
Seeing her burst into tears again, he regretted the brutality of his words.
"Now I understand how over the years I've lied to you, and I've lied to myself.
I didn't intend to deceive you when we ran away from the village or when I saw you at Hanada Bridge, but I did, by pretending to be cold and indifferent. That wasn't the way I really felt. In a little while, I'll be dead. What I'm about to say is the truth. I love you, Otsu. I'd throw everything to the four winds and live out my life with you, if only... After a moment's pause, he continued in a more forceful vein. You must believe every word I say, because I'll never have another chance to tell you this. I speak with neither pride nor pretense. There have been days when I couldn't concentrate for thinking about you. Nights I couldn't sleep for dreaming of you. Hot, passionate dreams, Otsu. Dreams that nearly drove me mad. Often I've hugged my pallet, pretending it was you. But even when I felt like that, if I took up my sword and looked at it, the madness evaporated and my blood cooled. Her face turned toward him, tearful but as radiant as a morning glory, she started to speak. Seeing the fervor in his eyes, her words caught in her throat and she looked at the ground again. The sword is my refuge. Anytime my passion threatens to overcome me, I force myself back into the world of swordsmanship. This is my fate, Otsu. I'm torn between love and self-discipline. I seem to be traveling on two paths at once. Yet when the paths diverge, I invariably manage to keep myself on the right one. I know myself better than anyone else does. I'm neither a genius nor a great man. He became silent again. Despite his desire to express his feelings honestly, his words seemed to him to be concealing the truth. His heart told him to be even more candid. That's the kind of man I am. What else can I say? I think of my sword, and you disappear into some dark corner of my mind. No, disappear altogether, leaving no trace. At times like that, I'm happiest and most satisfied with my life. Do you understand? All this time you've suffered, you've risked body and soul on a man who loves his sword more than he loves you. I'll die to vindicate my sword, but I wouldn't die for the love of a woman. Not even you. As much as I'd like to fall on my knees and beg your forgiveness, I can't. He felt her sensitive fingers tighten on his wrist. She was no longer crying. I know all that, she said emphatically. If I didn't know it, I wouldn't love you as I do. But can't you see the foolishness of dying on my account? For this one moment, I'm yours, body and soul. But once I've left you, you mustn't die for the love of a man like me. There's a good way, a proper way for a woman to live, Otsu. You must search for it. Make a happy life for yourself. These must be my parting words. It's time for me to go. Gently, he removed her hand from his wrist and stood up. She caught his sleeve and cried, Musashi, just 1 minute more. There were so many things she wanted to tell him. She did not care if he forgot her when he was not with her. She did not mind being called insignificant. She'd had no delusions about his character when she fell in love with him. She caught his sleeve again, her eyes searching his, trying to prolong this last moment, to keep it from ever ending. Her silent appeal nearly undid him. There was beauty even in the weakness that prevented her from speaking. Overcome by his own weakness and fear, he felt himself to be a tree with brittle roots, menaced by a raging wind. He wondered if his chaste devotion to the way of the sword would crumble like a landslide under the weight of her tears. To break the silence, he asked, Do you understand?
Yes, she said weakly. I understand perfectly. But if you die, I'll die too. My dying will have a meaning to me, just as yours has to you. If you can face the end calmly, so can I.
I won't be trampled down like an insect or drown in a moment of grief. I have to decide for myself. Nobody else can do it for me, not even you."
With great strength and perfect calm, she went on, "If in your heart you'll consider me to be your bride, that's enough, a joy and a blessing that only I, of all the women in the world, possess. You said you didn't want to make me unhappy. I can assure you I won't die because of unhappiness. There are people who seem to consider me unfortunate, yet I don't feel that way in the least. I look forward with pleasure to the day when I die. It will be like a glorious morning when the birds are singing. I'll go as happily as I would to my wedding." Nearly out of breath, she folded her arms over her breast and gazed up contentedly, as though captivated by a delightful dream. The moon seemed to be sinking rapidly. Though it was still not daybreak, mist had begun to rise through the trees. The silence was shattered by a horrifying scream that rent the air like the screech of a mythical bird. It came from the cliff Jotaro had climbed earlier. Startled out of her dreams, Otsu directed her eyes to the top of the cliff. Musashi chose this moment to leave. Without a word, he simply withdrew from her side and walked away toward his appointment with death. Otsu, with a stifled cry, ran a few steps after him. Musashi ran farther ahead, then turned back and said, "I understand your feelings, Otsu, but please don't die a cowardly death. Don't, because of your sorrow, allow yourself to sink into the valley of death and succumb like a weakling. Get well first, then think about it. I'm not throwing my life away for a useless cause. I've chosen to do what I'm doing because, by dying, I can achieve eternal life. Depend on one thing. My body may turn to dust, but I'll still be alive." Catching his breath, he added a warning. "Are you listening? By attempting to follow me in death, you may find that you're dying alone. You may look for me in the world beyond, only to find I'm not there. I intend to live on for 100 or 1,000 years, in the hearts of my countrymen, in the spirit of Japanese swordsmanship." He was out of hearing before she could speak again. She felt her very soul had left her, but she did not think of this as a parting. It was more as though the two of them were being engulfed in a great wave of life and death. A cascade of dirt and pebbles came to rest at the foot of the cliff, followed closely by Jotaro, wearing the grotesque mask he had received from the widow in Nara. Throwing his hands up, he said, "I've never been so surprised in my life!" "What happened?" whispered Otsu, not quite recovered from the shock of seeing the mask. "Didn't you hear it? I don't know why, but all of a sudden there was this horrible scream." "Where were you? Were you wearing that mask?" "I was above the cliff. There's a path up there about as wide as this one. After I climbed up a little way, I found a nice big rock, so I was just sitting there looking at the moon." "The mask. Did you have it on?" "Yes. I could hear foxes howling and maybe badgers or something rustling around near me. I thought the mask would scare them away. Then I heard the shriek, blood-curdling, like it was coming from a ghost in hell." Stray Geese.
"Wait for me, Matahachi. Why do you have to walk so fast?"
Osugi, far behind and completely winded, had forfeited both patience and pride. Matahachi, in a voice calculated to be heard, grumbled,
"She was in such a hurry when we left the inn, but listen to her now. She talks better than she walks."
As far as the foot of Mount Daimonji, they had been on the road to Ichijoji, but now, deep in the mountains, they were lost. Osugi would not give up.
"The way you keep picking on me," she rasped. "Anybody would think you had a terrible grudge against your own mother."
By the time she had wiped the sweat from her wrinkled face, Matahachi was off again.
"Won't you slow down?" she cried. "Let's sit here for a while."
"If you keep stopping every 10 feet to rest, we won't be there before sunrise."
"The sun won't be up for a long time yet. Ordinarily, I wouldn't have any trouble on a mountain road like this, but I'm coming down with a cold."
"You'll never admit you're wrong, will you? Back there, when I woke up the innkeeper so you could rest, you couldn't sit still for a minute. You didn't want anything to drink, so you started carrying on about how we'd be late. I hadn't had 2 sips before you dragged me out of the place. I know you're my mother, but you're a hard woman to get along with."
"Ha! Still peeved because I wouldn't let you drink yourself silly? Is that it? Why can't you exercise a little restraint? We have important things to do today."
"It's not as if we're going to whip out our swords and do the job ourselves. All we have to do is get a lock of Musashi's hair or something off the body. There's nothing so hard about that."
"Have it your way. No use fighting with each other like this. Let's go."
As they started walking again, Matahachi resumed his disgruntled soliloquy.
"The whole thing's stupid. We take a lock of hair back to the village and offer it as proof that our great mission in life had been accomplished. Those bumpkins have never been out of the mountains, so they'll be impressed. Oh, how I hate that village."
Not only had he not lost his fondness for the good sake of Nada, the pretty girls of Kyoto, and a number of other things, he still believed the city was where he would get his lucky break. Who could deny that one morning he mightn't wake up with everything he'd ever wanted?
"I'll never go back to that piddling village," he vowed silently.
Osugi, again lagging a good distance behind, cast dignity to the winds.
"Matahachi," she wheedled, "carry me on your back, won't you? Please, just for a short while."
He frowned, said nothing, but stopped to let her catch up. Just as she reached him, their ears were assaulted by the shriek of terror that had jolted Otsu and Jotaro. Faces blankly curious, they stood still, listening keenly. A moment later, Osugi uttered a cry of dismay as Matahachi ran abruptly to the edge of the cliff.
"What? Where are you going?"
"It must be down there," he said, and disappeared over the edge of the cliff. "Stay there. I'll see who it is."
Osugi recovered in no time.
"Fool," she shouted. "Where are you going?"
"You deaf? Didn't you hear that scream?
What's that got to do with you? Come back. Come back here."
Ignoring her, he rapidly made his way from tree root to tree root to the bottom of the little ravine.
"Fool! Numbskull!"
she cried. She might as well have been barking at the moon. Matahachi again shouted to her to stay where she was, but he was so far down that Osugi barely heard him.
"Now what?" he thought, beginning to regret his impulsiveness.
If he was wrong about where the cry had come from, he was wasting time and energy. Though no moonlight penetrated the foliage, his eyes gradually became accustomed to the dark. He came upon one of the many shortcuts crisscrossing the mountains east of Kyoto and leading to Sakamoto and Otsu. Walking alongside a brook with tiny waterfalls and rapids, he found a hut, probably a shelter for men who came to spear mountain trout. It was too small to hold more than one person, and obviously empty, but behind it he spotted a crouching figure, face and hands starkly white.
"It's a woman," he thought with satisfaction, and concealed himself behind a large rock.
After a couple of minutes, the woman crept from behind the hut, went to the edge of the stream, and scooped up some water to drink. He took a step forward. As though warned by animal instinct, the girl looked around furtively and started to flee.
"Akemi!
Oh, you frightened me!"
But there was relief in her voice. She swallowed the water that had caught in her throat and heaved a deep sigh. After eyeing her up and down, Matahachi asked,
"What happened? What are you doing here at this hour of the night, dressed in traveling clothes?
Where's your mother?"
"She's up there," he waved his arm.
"I bet she's furious."
"About the money?"
"Yes. I'm really sorry, Matahachi.
I had to leave in a hurry, and I didn't have enough to pay my bill and nothing to travel on. I know it was wrong, but I panicked. Please forgive me. Don't make me go back. I promise I'll return the money someday."
She melted into tears.
"Why all the apologies? Oh, I see. You think we came up here to catch you."
"Oh, I don't blame you. Even if it was just a wild impulse, I did run away with the money. If I'm caught and treated like a thief, I guess I can't really complain."
"That's the way Mother would look at it, but I'm not like that. Anyway, it wasn't very much. If you really needed it, I'd have been glad to give it to you. I'm not angry. I'm much more interested in why you left so suddenly and what you're doing up here."
"I overheard you and your mother talking tonight."
"Oh? About Musashi?"
Yes.
"And you decided all of a sudden to go to Ichijoji?"
She didn't answer.
"Oh, I forgot,"
he exclaimed, recalling his purpose and coming down into the ravine.
"Were you the one who screamed a few minutes ago?"
She nodded, then quickly stole a frightened glance at the slope above them. Satisfied that nothing was there, she told him how she had crossed the stream and was climbing a steep crag when she looked up and saw an incredibly evil-looking ghost sitting on a high rock, staring at the moon. It had the body of a midget, but the face, that of a woman, was an eerie color, whiter than white, with a mouth that slashed up on one side to the ear. It seemed to be laughing grotesquely at her, and had frightened her out of her wits. Before she came to her senses, she had already slid back down into the ravine. Though the tale sounded absurd, she told it with deadly seriousness. Matachi tried to listen politely, but was soon overcome with laughter.
"Aha! You're making it all up! You probably frightened the ghost! Why, you used to roam the battlefields and didn't even wait for the dead spirits to leave before you started stripping the corpses."
"I was only a child then. I didn't know enough to be afraid."
"You weren't all that young. I gather you're still pining over Musashi."
"No. He was my first love, but..."
"Then why go to Ichijoji?"
"I don't really know myself. I just thought that if I went, I might see him."
"You're wasting your time," he said emphatically,
then told her Musashi didn't have a chance in a thousand of coming out of the battle alive. After what had happened to her at the hands of Seijuro and Kojiro, thoughts of Musashi could no longer conjure up images of the bliss she had once imagined sharing with him. Having neither died nor found a life that appealed to her, she felt like a soul in limbo, a goose separated from the flock and lost. As he stared at her profile, Matachi was struck by the similarity between her situation and his. They had both been cut adrift from their moorings. Something in her powdered face suggested that she was looking for a companion. He put his arm around her, brushed his cheek against hers, and whispered,
"Akemi, let's go to Edo."
To Edo? You must be joking," she said.
But the idea shook her out of her trance. Tightening his hold on her shoulders, he said,
"It doesn't necessarily have to be Edo, but everybody says it's the city of the future. Osaka and Kyoto are old now. Maybe that's why the shogun's building a new capital in the east. If we go there now, there should still be lots of good jobs, even for a couple of stray geese like you and me. Come on, Akemi. Say you'll go."
Encouraged by the growing spark of interest in her face, he went on more fervently,
"We could have fun, Akemi. We could do the things we want to do. Why live if you can't do that? We're young. We've got to learn to be bold and clever.
Neither of us will get anywhere acting like weaklings. The more you try to be good and honest and conscientious, the harder fate kicks you in the teeth and laughs at you. You end up crying your heart out. And where does that get you? Look, that's the way it's always been for us, isn't it? You've done nothing but let yourself be devoured by that mother of yours and some brutal men. From now on, you've got to be the one who eats rather than the one who gets gobbled up."
she was beginning to be swayed. Her mother's tea house had been a cage from which they had both fled. Since then, the world had shown her nothing but cruelty. She sensed that Matahachi was stronger and better able to cope with life than she. After all, he was a man.
"Will you go?" he asked.
Even though she knew it was as if the house had burned down and she was trying to rebuild it with the ashes, it took some effort to shake off her fantasy, the rapturous daydream in which Musashi was hers and hers alone. But finally she nodded without speaking.
"Then it's settled. Let's go, now."
"What about your mother?"
"Oh, her?"
he sniffed. He glanced up at the cliff.
"If she manages to lay hands on something to prove that Musashi's dead, she'll go back to the village. No doubt she'll be mad as a hornet when she finds I'm not around. I can hear her now, telling everybody how I left her on the mountain to die, the way they used to throw away old women in some parts of the country. But if I make a success of myself, that'll make up for everything. Anyway, we've made up our minds. Let's go."
He strode off ahead, but she hung back.
"Matahachi, not that way."
"Why?"
"We'll have to pass that rock again."
"Aha! And see the midget with a woman's face? Forget it. I'm with you now. Oh, listen, isn't that my mother calling? Hurry up before she comes looking for me. She's a lot worse than a small ghost with a scary face."
The Spreading Pine. The wind soughed in the bamboo. Though it was still too dark to take flight, birds were awake and chirping.
"Don't attack! It's me, Kojiro!"
Having run like a demon for more than a mile, he was breathing heavily when he reached the spreading pine. The faces of the men who emerged from their hiding places to encircle him were numb from waiting.
"Didn't you find him?"
Genzaimon asked impatiently.
"I found him, all right,"
replied Kojiro, with an inflection that turned every eye upon him. Looking around coolly, he said,
"I found him, and we walked together up the Takano River for a way, but then he..."
"He ran away!"
exclaimed Miike Jurozaimon.
"No!"
Kojiro said emphatically.
"To judge from his calmness and from what he said, I don't think he did. At first it seemed that way, but on second thought, I decided he was just trying to get rid of me. He's probably devised some strategy he wanted to conceal from me. Better keep your guard up."
"Strategy? What kind of strategy?"
They jostled closer to avoid missing a word.
"I suspect he's enlisted several seconds. He was probably on his way to meet them so they could attack all at once."
"Ugh," groaned Genzaimon. "That seems likely. It also means it won't be long before they arrive."
Jurozaimon separated himself from the group and ordered the men back to their stations.
"If Musashi attacks while we're scattered like this," he warned, "we may lose the first skirmish. We don't know how many men he'll have with him, but it can't be very many. We'll stick to our original plan."
"He's right. Mustn't be caught off guard."
"It's easy to make a mistake when you're tired of waiting. Be careful."
"Get to your posts."
Gradually they dispersed. The musketeer resettled himself in the upper branches of the pine tree. Kojiro, noticing Genjiro standing stiffly with his back to the trunk, asked,
"Sleepy?"
"No,"
the boy replied pluckily. Kojiro patted him on the head.
"Your lips have turned blue. You must be cold. Since you're the representative of the House of Yoshioka, you have to be brave and strong. Be patient a little longer, and you'll see some interesting things happen."
Walking away, he added, "Now I have to find a good place for myself." The moon had traveled with Musashi from the hollow between Shiga Hill and Uryu Hill, where he'd left Otsu. Now it sank behind the mountain as a gradual upward movement of the clouds resting on the 36 peaks served notice that the world would soon be beginning its daily chores. He quickened his pace. Directly below him, a temple roof came into view, It's not far now, he thought. He looked up and reflected that in only a short time, a few breaths, his spirit would join the clouds in their skyward flight. To the universe, the death of one man could hardly have any more significance than that of a butterfly. But in the realm of mankind, a single death could affect everything, for better or worse. Musashi's only concern now was how to die a noble death. The welcome sound of water struck his ears. Stopping and kneeling at the foot of a tall rock, he scooped some water from the brook and drank quickly. His tongue smarted from its freshness, an indication, he hoped, that his spirit was calm and collected and his courage had not deserted him. Taking a moment to rest, he seemed to hear voices calling him. Otsu? Jotaro? He knew it couldn't be Otsu. She was not the kind to lose control of herself and chase after him at a time like this. She knew him too well for that. Still, he couldn't rid himself of the notion that he was being beckoned. He looked back several times, hoping to see someone. The thought that he might be having delusions was unnerving. But he couldn't afford to waste any more time. Being late would not only mean breaking his promise, but put him at a considerable disadvantage. For a lone warrior attempting to take on an army of opponents, the ideal time, he surmised, was the brief interval after the moon had set but before the sky was completely light. He recalled the old saying, "It is easy to crush an enemy outside oneself, but impossible to defeat an enemy within." He had vowed to expel Otsu from his thoughts, and even bluntly told her this as she had clung to his sleeve. Yet he seemed unable to shake her voice from his mind. He cursed softly. I'm acting like a woman. A man on a man's mission has no business thinking about frivolities like love. He spurred himself on, running as fast as he could. Then all at once he caught sight, below him, of a white ribbon rising from the foot of the mountain through the bamboo and trees and fields. One of the roads to Ichijoji. He was only about 400 yards from the point where it met with the other two roads. Through the milky mist, he could make out the branches of the great spreading pine. He dropped to his knees, his body tense. Even the trees around him seemed transformed into potential enemies. As nimbly as a lizard, he left the path and made his way to a point directly above the pine tree. A gust of cold wind swept down from the mountaintop, pushing the mist in a great rolling wave over the pine trees and bamboo. The branches of the spreading pine quivered, as though to warn the world of impending disaster. Straining his eyes, he could just discern the figures of 10 men standing perfectly still around the pine tree, their lances poised. The presence of others elsewhere on the mountain he could feel, even though he couldn't see them. Musashi knew he had now entered the province of death. A feeling of awe brought goose pimples even to the backs of his hands, but his breathing was deep and steady. Down to the tips of his toes, he was keyed for action. As he crept slowly forward, his toes gripped the ground with the strength and sureness of fingers. A stone embankment that might once have been part of a fortress was nearby. On an impulse, he made his way among the rocks to the eminence on which it had stood. There he found a stone torii looking straight down on the spreading pine. Behind it was the sacred precinct, protected by rows of tall evergreens, among which he could see a shrine building. Though he had no idea which deity was honored here, he ran through the grove to the shrine gate and knelt before it. With death so near, he could not keep his heart from trembling at the thought of the sacred presence. The shrine was dark inside, save for a holy lamp swaying in the wind, threatening to expire, then miraculously recapturing its full brightness. The plaque above the door read, Hachidai Shrine. Musashi took comfort from the thought that he had a powerful ally, that if he charged down the mountain, the god of war would be behind him. The gods, he knew, always supported the side that was right. He recalled how the great Nobunaga, on his way to the Battle of Okehazama,
had paused to pay his respects at the Atsuta Shrine. The discovery of this holy place seemed felicitous indeed. Just inside the gate was a stone basin, where supplicants could cleanse themselves before praying. He rinsed out his mouth, then took a second mouthful and sprayed water on the hilt of his sword and the cords of his sandals. Thus purified, he hitched up his sleeves with a leather thong and tied on a cotton headband. Flexing his leg muscles as he walked, he went to the steps of the shrine and put his hand on the rope hanging from the gong above the entrance. In time-honored fashion, he was about to give the gong a rap and say a prayer to the deity. Catching himself, he quickly withdrew his hand. "What am I doing?" he thought in horror. The rope, plaited with red and white cotton cord, seemed to be inviting him to take hold of it, sound the gong, and make his supplication. He stared at it. "What was I going to request?" he asked himself. "What need have I of the help of the gods? Am I not already one with the universe? Haven't I always said I must be prepared to face death at any time? Haven't I trained myself to face death calmly and confidently?" He was appalled. Without thinking, without remembering his years of training and self-discipline, he had been on the brink of begging for supernatural assistance. Something was wrong, for deep down he knew that the samurai's true ally was not the gods, but death itself. Last night and earlier this morning, he had felt confident that he had come to terms with his fate. And yet there he was, within a hairbreadth of forgetting all he had ever learned, beseeching aid from the deity. Head drooped in shame, he stood there like a rock. "What a fool I am! I thought I'd achieve purity and enlightenment, but there is still within me something that longs to go on living. Some delusion stirring up thoughts of Otsu or my sister. Some false hope leading me to clutch at any straw. A diabolical yearning causing me to forget myself, tempting me to pray to the gods for help." He was disgusted, exasperated, with his body, with his soul, with his failure to master the way. The tears he had held back in Otsu's presence poured from his eyes. "It was all unconscious. I had no intention of praying, hadn't even thought of what I was going to pray for. But if I'm doing things unconsciously, that makes it all the worse." Racked by doubt, he felt foolish and inadequate. Had he ever had the ability to become a warrior in the first place? If he had achieved the state of calm he had aspired to, there should have been no need, not even a subconscious need, for prayers or supplications. In one shattering moment, only minutes before the battle, he had discovered in his heart the true seeds of defeat. It was impossible now to regard his approaching death as the culmination of a samurai's life. In the next breath, a surge of gratitude swept over him. The presence and magnanimity of the deity enveloped him. The battle had not yet begun. The real test still lay before him. He had been warned in time. By recognizing his failure, he had overcome it. Doubt vanished. The deity had guided him to this place to teach him this. While believing sincerely in the gods, he did not consider it the way of the samurai to seek their aid. The way was an ultimate truth transcending gods and Buddhas. Stepping back a pace, he folded his hands and, rather than ask for protection, thanked the gods for their timely help. After a quick bow, he hurried out of the shrine compound and down the narrow, steep path, the sort of path which a heavy downpour would quickly convert into a rushing stream. Pebbles and brittle clumps of dirt tumbled down at his heels, breaking the silence. When the spreading pine came into view again, he leaped off the path and crouched in the bushes. Not a drop of dew had yet fallen from the leaves, and his knees and chest were soon drenched. The pine tree was no more than 40 or 50 paces below him.
He could see the man with the musket in its branches. His anger flashed.
"Cowards," he said, almost out loud. "All this against one man."
In a way, he felt a little sorry for an enemy who had to go to such extremes. Still, he had expected something like this and was, insofar as possible, prepared for it. Since they would naturally assume that he was not alone, prudence would dictate that they have at least one flying weapon, and probably more. If they were also using short bows, the archers were probably hidden behind rocks or on lower ground. Musashi had one great advantage. Both the man in the tree and the men underneath it had their backs to him. Stooping so low that the hilt of his sword rose above his head, he crept, almost crawled forward. Then he covered about 20 paces at a dead run. The musketeer twisted his head around and spotted him and shouted, "There he is!" Musashi ran on another 10 paces, knowing that the man would have to reverse his position to aim and fire.
"Where?"
cried the men nearest the tree.
"Behind you!"
came the throat-splitting reply. The musketeer had his weapon trained on Musashi's head. While sparks from the fuse showered down, Musashi's right elbow described an arc in the air. The rock he hurled hit the fuse squarely with terrific force. The musketeer's scream mingled with the sound of cracking branches as he plunged to the ground. In an instant, Musashi's name was on every man's lips. Not one of them had taken the trouble to think the situation through, to imagine that he might devise a means of attacking the central core first. Their confusion was all but total. In their rush to reorient themselves, the 10 men bumped into each other, got their weapons tangled, tripped each other with their lances, and otherwise displayed a perfect picture of disorder, all the while screaming at each other not to let Musashi escape. Just as they sorted themselves out and began to form a semicircle, they were challenged.
"I am Miyamoto Musashi, the son of Shinmen Munisai of Mimasaka Province. I have come in accordance with our agreement made the day before yesterday at Yanagimachi. Genjiro, are you there? I beg you not to be careless like Seijiro and Denshiro before you. I understand that, because of your youth, you have several score men to support you. I, Musashi, have come alone. Your men may attack individually or in a group, as they wish. Now, fight!"
Another total surprise. No one expected Musashi to deliver a formal challenge. Even those who would desperately have liked to reply in kind lacked the necessary composure.
"Musashi, you're late!"
cried a hoarse voice. Many took encouragement from Musashi's declaration that he was alone, but Genzaimon and Jurozaimon, believing it was a trick, started looking around for phantom seconds. A loud twang off to one side was followed a split second later by the glint of Musashi's sword flashing through the air. The arrow aimed at his face broke, half falling behind his shoulder, the other half near the tip of his lowered sword. Or rather, where his sword had just been, for Musashi was already on the move. His hair bristling like a lion's mane, he was bounding toward the shadowy form behind the spreading pine. Genjiro hugged the trunk, screaming, "Help! I'm scared!" Genzaimon jumped forward, howling as though the blow had struck him, but he was too late. Musashi's sword sliced a 2-foot strip of bark off the trunk. It fell to the ground by Genjiro's blood-covered head. It was the act of a ferocious demon. Musashi, ignoring the others, had made straight for the boy. And it seemed he had had this in mind from the beginning. The assault was of a savagery beyond conception. Genjiro's death did not reduce the Yoshioka's fighting capacity in the slightest. What had been nervous excitement rose to the level of murderous frenzy.
"Beast!"
screamed Genzaimon, face livid with grief and rage. He rushed headlong at Musashi, wielding a sword somewhat too heavy for a man of his age. Musashi shifted his right heel back a foot or so, leaned aside, and struck upward, grazing Genzaimon's elbow and face with the tip of his sword. It was impossible to tell who wailed, for at that moment, a man attacking Musashi from the rear with a lance stumbled forward and fell on top of the old man. The next instant, a third swordsman, coming from the front, was sliced from shoulder to navel. His head sagged and his arms went limp.